cold fear. The fear of the murderer disposing of the body, which would give deadly...
I laid the carpet in the backyard and threw about 20 or 30 buckets of water on it to try to wash the blood off. And the colour of the water that came off was like blood.
Next thing I remember was something scratching and pulling at my mouth. I opened my eyes, and Jean was lying there under me, and I had my hands around her throat.
Murder Most Foul. Six classic murder cases presented by Nick Ross. Case 3, The Major, The Scone, and The Dandelions.
Good shot, Major.
30 all. Ready?
I say, well done. You really are on form today, Major. 40-30. Set point, isn't it?
I do believe it is.
Herbert?
Yes, my dear?
Come, Herbert. It's 6 o'clock.
Yes, dear.
Hay on Wye is a small town, and in 1920, when it was simply called Hay, it was even smaller. So everyone knew everyone else's business. And everyone knew that dapper little Major Armstrong was henpecked.
Can't we just finish the game, old man? It's a pretty exciting point.
And don't forget, tonight is your bath night, Herbert.
No, best not, Doctor. Sorry. Coming, my dear.
He'd arrived in the town in 1906. He was a solicitor. He married the following year and joined the Colours in 1914. He returned in 1919 to continue his practice. He was a man of perhaps excessive dignity, maybe because he was so tiny. He only weighed 7 stone. But he was far more popular than the town's other solicitor. And he was indeed a figure of some importance. He was clerk to the local magistrates, and since they weren't lawyers, he in effect ran their court. But at home, he was completely under the thumb of his wife, who would allow no alcohol in the house, and even if they were dining out with friends, her rule applied.
Yes, I have indeed. I want more.
Claret or burgundy, sir?
Oh, thank you, no. The Major does not take wine.
No, thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, the King.
The King. Yes, sir.
Would you care for a cigar, sir?
He most certainly would not. Puffing filthy tobacco is a disgusting and antisocial habit.
No, thank you.
Perhaps a glass of port, sir?
I think you may have a glass of port, Herbert. It will do your cold good.
Thank you.
She really was that tough. But, in fairness, it should be said that she probably wasn't altogether right in the head at this time. She suffered from pain in the arm and a numbing in the fingers of one hand. She had been a talented pianist, but now found herself unable to play. Dr. Hinks, who was also a friend of the family, could find little physically wrong, and described her physical symptoms as functional, that is, brought on by her mental state, which by August 1920 was giving him cause for concern. She'd become acutely depressed and morbidly self-critical.
Doctor, oh, Doctor, I'm a disgrace to my family. I have wrecked poor Herbert's career and the children. I confess I've been a terrible mother. Awful.
You haven't, Catherine. That's simply not true.
It is. I must leave home. Yes. Do you know, there's a warrant out for my arrest.
No, there isn't.
There is, I tell you. I've lived an unchristian life. I've been cruel to my children and I've been cheating the tradesmen, defrauding them. They're watching me, you know. They're trying to trap me. They're going to arrest me.
I'm sure they're not. Now, here, let me take your pulse.
Instead of the normal 80, her pulse was up to 120. She was vomiting frequently. Her lips were blue and her complexion sallow. There was evidence of a heart murmur. After calling in a second opinion, Dr. Hinks certified her as of unsound mind, as did the other doctor, Dr. Jane. Dr. Hinks and the Major travelled with her to Barnwood Private Asylum. She was to remain there for 4.5 months. During that time, life was rather more relaxed at Mayfield, the Major's house. He gave little dinner parties, where wine was drunk, and cigars were smoked quite openly. He went off to London quite a lot, and he spent a lot of time seeing to his garden. He was proud of his large garden. He'd won several prizes at local flower shows, but there was one great problem with it, as his gardener, Will Jay, explained.
It's a terrible garden for weeds, this is, you know, sir.
I am aware of that, Jay.
They used to keep a boy here in the old days. Nothing to do all day but pull up weeds.
So I'm told.
It's on account of it being practically surrounded by fields, you see.
Yes,
that's
indeed.
Where all these plantains and dandelions come from, sir.
What about weed killer? For the dandelions.
Would you like me to get some, sir?
No, I prefer my own. I've got the materials.
I wouldn't put it down this dry weather, sir. Tends to lie around. Needs to soak in, you see.
Well, not the way I use it, Jay. Not the way I use it.
As well as gardening, the Major had other interests, which explained his increasingly frequent visits to London. He was often there on business, even when his wife was at home. He was something of a gambler, although an unsuccessful one. And, well, Dr. Hinks was treating him, in confidence, of course, for venereal disease. The Major was a good lawyer, with a good and growing practice. Nonetheless, his trips to London meant he was living well beyond his means. And the fees charged by Barnwood can't have been cheap. But Mrs. Armstrong was making excellent progress. She was even playing the piano again. Ever solicitous for her, her husband felt she would benefit from a return to the bosom of her family. He told Dr. Hinks how much better she was and got him to write to Dr. Townsend, who was in charge of Barnwood.
Dear Dr. Townsend, I'm glad to hear that Mrs. Armstrong is improving mentally and physically. From what Major Armstrong tells me, she appears to have lost her delusions and to be normal mentally. Her principal worry seems to be her surroundings and her desire to get home to start her household duties again.
Dear Dr. Hinks, Mrs. Armstrong has improved both mentally and physically, and Major Armstrong is very desirous of having her home. However, in my opinion, she is not yet well mentally. She is constantly making accusations against herself of having misspent her life and failed in her duty towards her husband and children. So you see, her delusions have not gone. Her great anxiety is to return home, and so under the circumstances, I think it would be well to get from the committee on Monday next a leave of absence on trial for 3 months.
Mrs. Armstrong came home on the 22nd of January. For a week or so, she was very much better, but, alas, her recovery was brief. At first, it was her feet. She developed what might be described today as a John Cleese funny walk. The doctors called it a high steppage gait. She would raise her foot high off the ground, hesitate for a long time, and then bring it down with a bang. Dr. Townsend had noticed the same thing, but had written to Dr. Hinks to say it was functional and had no physical cause. If it was purely in her mind, so Dr. Hinks reasoned, he might be able to persuade her out of it by walking her round the room. This was on the 11th of February.
I feel as though I have springs under the soles of my feet pressing me to the ground.
Here, now, take my arm. I'm sure you can do it.
No. No, I can't.
Come now, make the effort.
I can't. I can't.
You can. Try.
Very well. No, I can't do it.
Soon she again found it hard to use her hands. Dr. Hinks tested the knee jerk, the automatic reaction to the knee being tapped sharply. Nothing happened. When he left on the 11th, she was back in bed. On the 16th of February, he was called and examined her again.
How is she, Tom?
Not good, I'm afraid, Major. Right back to where she was before she went to Barnwood, I'm afraid.
Oh, dear.
She's vomiting again.
Well, as I told you, she's always had these bilious attacks. She's a martyr to indigestion.
Now, this is worse than that. She's got intense pain in her abdomen. She could hardly bear me to touch it.
Appendicitis?
No sign of that. But the heart murmurs back.
I see.
Her pulse is right back up to 120. And the cyanosis of the lips is back.
Of the what?
The blueness.
Oh, yes.
I must tell you the truth. I'm afraid the prognosis isn't good, Major. But I'll leave you some medicine.
Thank you for everything, Tom.
Dr. Hinks came to see her every day. She could take no food or drink. She had a nurse, but the Major often took over from her. Mrs. Armstrong's complexion became copper-coloured, and she got extremely thin. Eventually, on February the 22nd, she died. Dr. Hinks signed the death certificate.
Cause of death, heart disease over 12 months, nephritis over 6 months, and gastritis 21 days. Dr. Thomas E. Hinks, registered.
Mrs. Armstrong was buried 3 days later in the little churchyard at Cusop. Only 4 people attended the funeral. But on the following Sunday, the rector turned the service into a kind of memorial for her. The Major read the lessons with great feeling.
And I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth were passed away, and there was no more sea. And I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven, as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a great voice out of heaven saying, "Behold, the tabernacle of God is with men."
Hay on Wye, as we now call it, is a charming place with narrow streets, a ruined castle, a tall clock tower, and pretty little shops. Nowadays, an awful lot of them are bookshops. It's just the sort of place you'd expect to find Miss Marple. The people involved even sound like something out of Miss Christie's books. The Major, the Doctor, the Gardener, and those we've yet to meet. The man with the scarred face and the mystery woman. But this was real. A real woman had died in real pain. Her will was read. There were 2 wills, one of 1917, leaving most of Mrs. Armstrong's £2,000 to her 3 children. That was written in her own hand. And a later will, dated June the 8th, 1920, a couple of months before she was certified as of unsound mind. This was written in the Major's hand, and it left her little all to him. Think again of Agatha Christie. Now, here were all the elements she relished, including, as we've seen, tennis parties, tea parties, as we shall see, and poison. Indeed, not just any poison, but the novelist's favourite, arsenic. Major Armstrong's weed killer. The punctilious Major, having bought it in half-pound packs, apparently had his own curious technique for using it in his war against the dandelions.
Divide the package up. Take 4 ounces and divide them into 2 small packets of 2 ounces. From each make a score of tiny packets. Driving an old file into the ground, drop 1 of the tiny packets into each aperture. Do this in the case of each dandelion, taking a separate dose to each.
And so Major Armstrong, or so he said, wiped out a total of 19 dandelions. Indeed, one of these tiny packets was found in what he claimed was his gardening kit. It contained rather more than over 3 grains of arsenic, just the right amount to kill a human being. I said that the Major wasn't the only solicitor in Hay in the early 20s. The other, rather less popular solicitor, was Mr. Oswald Martin. His office was exactly opposite the Major's. Mr. Martin had a scarred face that made him look as if he was smiling rather cruelly. He was deaf in one ear, and thanks to the semi-paralysis of half his face, spoke rather clumsily. Nothing could be in greater contrast to the smart, military bearing of the Major. Yet both gentlemen had been involved in the war. The Major, understandably as one who had served in the war to end all wars, insisted that everyone address him by his military rank. Mr. Martin didn't. Indeed, I've no idea what his rank was. He might have been a private soldier, for all I know. But the difference between them was that the Major had spent his entire war service in England, whereas Mr. Martin had spent his on the Western Front, where he had finally been severely wounded in the face in 1918. I promised you a tea party. It was given by the Major at Mayfield for Mr. Martin 7 months after Mrs. Armstrong's death.
From Martin and Griffiths, solicitors, Hay. Dear Major Armstrong, As you know, we have been instructed by Mr. John Jones of Breckfa to act on his behalf regarding the purchase of the Velen Naweth estate at Brecon. Deposits of a total of £500 were placed with you. It is now over a year since we entered into negotiations, and we have written to you several times on this topic. I must inform you that we have been instructed by our clients that unless completion takes place before the 20th of October 1921, they will rescind their contract and will require the return of the deposit you hold. Yours sincerely, Owen Martin, Solicitor at Law and Commissioner for Oaths. Hello, Martin.
Hello, Martin. Armstrong here. Look, I'm sorry about all this kerfuffle about the Velenowith estate. Why don't you pop over to Mayfield for tea? We can chat about the whole thing informally. And I'll show you around the garden. I'm rather proud of it, actually.
Oswald Martin was taken aback. The Major had previously been somewhat aloof. What's more, he noticed the Major's agitation. He wasn't to know that Major Armstrong no longer had the £500 deposit. The little flutters, the little trips to London, had eaten it all up. And he didn't yet have access to the cash from his wife's estate. There were trivial irregularities in the will, such as the fact that the witnesses had no idea what they were signing. When Oswald Martin arrived at Mayfield, he was, quite literally, led up the garden path. The Major spent half an hour walking him round the garden and lecturing him about the trials and tribulations of horticulture, before he steered him back towards the house for tea.
As I was saying, my dear Martin, all would be fine if it wasn't for these deuced weeds.
Yes, Major. Major, about the deposits.
I am a martyr to weeds. Now, my gardener was saying it's because we are surrounded by fields here.
My clients are adamant that...
The Major's left the tea thing. Sit you down.
Thank you. Have you been in touch with the vendors again?
Yes. Yes, still the same bother with the Yorkshire Penny Bank, would you believe? Look, let's have a cup of tea before we talk business, eh? Hmm. No shop in the mess? One lump or two?
Two, please. I'm afraid I am a little pressed for time.
And you must have one of these buttered scones. Excuse my fingers.
Thank you. I have to tell you, my clients...
Well, go on, try it. Try it. They're absolutely delicious.
Yes.
From the little shop in the high street, the cafe place.
Yes, it's very nice indeed. Major, I really must insist.
Oh, dear, look. There is Mr. Buchanan coming down the path. Rector, you know, possibly something about parish business. Oh, do excuse me a moment, Martin. There's some currant bread there. I believe that's one of your favourites. Help yourself. Excuse me? Mr. Buchanan!
They never did quite get round to talking about the repayment of that £500 deposit lodged with Major Armstrong. And when Mr. Martin eventually left, it was 6:30. It took him 20 minutes to get home in his car. Mr. Martin was newly married. His bride was a trained nurse and the daughter of the village chemist, John Davis, the man who'd sold the Major his arsenic.
Hello, dear. How did it go?
It was strange. He seemed to want to do anything rather than talk about the estate.
Oh.
It was almost as though he had a personal interest in not getting it cleared up. Oh.
Are you all right, dear? You look a bit peaky.
I don't feel too good. Been working too hard.
Oh.
Look, if you don't mind, I'll skip dinner.
Oh, I cooked it specially.
Oh.
It's jugged hare and coffee custard afterwards.
Fine. No, I'll be all right. I'll try some, love, I will.
But he didn't eat much of it. At 9:10, he was sick. He went to bed and was then sick incessantly throughout the night. There was an intense pain in the abdomen and diarrhoea, and he was conscious of his heart. It was going extremely rapidly. Dr. Hinks came at 9:00 next morning.
Well, your temperature's normal. I must say you don't look too good, old man.
I don't feel too good.
Right. Let's have a look at your tongue. Oh, that's all right, anyway. Eyes pretty bloodshot. He's been vomiting a lot, you say, Mrs. Martin?
Yes, Doctor. It started very dark, but it's got much lighter. In the bowl there.
Yeah, I see. Now let's check your liver. No enlargement. Do you feel pain anywhere?
My stomach.
Right. Does that hurt?
No.
Not appendicitis. What about here?
Oh!
Sounds like food poisoning to me.
His pulse was very fast.
Oh, really? I'd better check it again, then.
If it was food poisoning, shouldn't I be ill, too? I had exactly the same food.
No, you didn't. Don't forget, I had tea at the Major's.
Well, maybe the Major's feeling queasy, too. Mm. Good Lord, your pulse is up to 120.
That's what it was last night.
Strange.
The ailment cleared up slowly, but much more slowly than Dr. Higgins expected. After Mr. Martin had been ill for 4 days, he decided to take a urine sample and get John Davis, the chemist, to send it off for clinical analysis. The sample contained arsenic, and quite a lot of arsenic, considering it was 4 days since the attack began and the amount of vomiting that had occurred. The doctor was a keen horseman, and it was while riding over to visit a distant patient that he drew conclusions which led him and Mr. Martin to have a discreet meeting with a very important figure.
So, you see, Chief Constable, Mrs. Armstrong's symptoms were, in effect, the same as Mr. Martin's here. Mm. I should have recognised it as arsenic poisoning at the time, but it's not the sort of thing you expect to find in a place like Hay.
I couldn't believe it.
Well, of course not. You say you've been in communication with a Dr. Townsend?
Yes, he's in charge of the Barnwood Asylum, where Mrs. Armstrong was sent. He completely concurs with my belief that she'd been receiving numerous non-fatal doses of arsenic for some time. These had accumulated within the body. This explains why her physical illness disappeared at the asylum as her body became cleansed of the poison, though her mental health remained much the same.
And the dosage was presumably started again when she got home. I see. Is there anything else?
Yes, these chocolates.
Chocolates, Mr. Martin?
They were sent to me anonymously in September. My wife and I don't like chocolates much, but when one of my relatives came over, she ate several and was violently ill afterwards with the same symptoms I had.
I see.
My father-in-law's a chemist and he had some of them analysed. If you look here, you'll see a small hole has been punched in the bottom of some of them and then covered over.
Yes, I see. And these ones contained arsenic?
Yes.
Well, it's a ticklish business, gentlemen. Major Armstrong is an important figure in Hay, not to mention in the magistrate's court. But I'll see what I can do. I'll need the urine sample and these chocolates for analysis by our people. In the meantime, Mr. Martin, don't accept any more tea invitations from the Major.
Well, but that's just the trouble. He keeps on inviting
me. Mr. Martin, whatever you do, don't go.
Martin here.
Major Armstrong here.
Major, are you ready to complete?
No, not quite. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
No more digestive trouble?
No.
Good. Look, would you care to come to tea tomorrow?
No. No, thank you. My wife and I are already engaged. I promised to go to Hereford to meet some friends.
What about the next day, then?
Book then as well, I'm afraid.
Friday, then?
Sorry, can't make it.
All in all, Oswald Martin received over 20 invitations to tea. Meanwhile, two Scotland Yard detectives were keeping the Major under observation. The two solicitors, being face-to-face across the street, could also watch each other and the comings and goings in their respective premises. This made it awkward when the Major took to having tea in his office.
Hello?
Martin?
Yes?
Come across and have a cup of tea. I've got some cakes and things in. Kettle's boiling. What about it?
I'm afraid I'm busy.
Oh, that's funny. I didn't see anyone go in.
I'm dictating some urgent letters.
Let them wait.
They can't wait. They've got to catch the post.
Later, Oswald Martin took to ordering his own tea in his office considerably earlier than the Major's. The Major would then be able to see that, as his rival had already taken tea, there was no point in inviting him across. Inevitably, though, this led to the Major taking his tea even earlier to get in first, and so it went on. The whole thing sounds wonderfully absurd, but it was hell for the young solicitor and his wife to live through. They took it in turns to lie awake at night, presumably in case a beckoning figure with a teacup and a scone appeared at their window. No one could have been more relieved when eventually on New Year's Day, Major Armstrong was arrested by the Chief Constable himself for the attempted murder of Oswald Norman Martin. And no one could have been more surprised than the Major. But he took it calmly and made a statement explaining all about the dandelions. The citizens of Hay were astonished. Many put it down to professional jealousy on the part of Oswald Martin. But then, the very next day, strange things were happening in Cusop Churchyard. Dr. Bernard Spilsbury was the most famous pathologist in the world. He'd taken the train from Paddington to Hereford, but there were only 3 trains a day on the little branch line to Hay, and he couldn't be expected to wait, so a police car was organised. It halted for a moment in Hay by the clock tower to pick up Dr. Hinks. It was dark when they reached the churchyard at Cusop, and snow lay on the ground. Canvas screens had been rigged up round Mrs. Armstrong's grave. The chief constable was already in the churchyard.
Looks like we're nearly there, Dr. Spilsbury.
Good.
Right, lads. That's it, I reckon.
You are?
Humphrey Webb, the undertaker, Dr. Spilsbury.
And you identify that coffin as Mrs. Armstrong's?
Oh, yes, sir.
Well, if you'll get your fellows to pull it out.
Yes, sir. Come on, lads. I'll give you a hand. This way. Come on.
Where are they taking it, Chief Constable?
That cottage over there. I've arranged for you to do your examination there. I'm afraid we're...
Dr. Hinks.
Dr. Spilsbury.
I must congratulate you on your perspicacity in this matter.
Thank you.
Yeah, here we are. Very quaint. Mr. Webb.
Doctor?
How are you doing?
Just this nice screw, sir. There she goes.
Good. Let's have the lid off. Ah. Well. What do you make of that, Dr. Hinks?
She's in a remarkable state of preservation.
Isn't she? And what does that suggest to you?
The antiseptic and preservative effects of arsenic.
So it does to me, Doctor. So it does to me. But let's not jump our guns, eh? I must get to work.
It was to be for the murder of Mrs. Armstrong that Major Armstrong would be tried. First of all, he had to appear before the local magistrates to establish whether there was a case to answer. And here the black comedy continued, since the Major himself was the clerk to the bench. His place was taken by an elderly colleague, the clerk to the bench at Talgarth. This was a post to which the Major himself had aspired. In fact, the Major had had the old clerk to dinner one evening together with the local inspector of taxes. Afterwards, the inspector had fallen ill with gastric trouble. Could the Major perhaps have served the specially prepared dish to the wrong man? In any case, the Talgarth clerk was very old indeed, and not really quite up to his onerous duties. Major Armstrong, in a spirit of professional camaraderie, offered to assist him, but the offer was refused. The Major was committed for trial at the next Herefordshire Assizes, and his fight for his own life began in earnest. But what about the victims? Not just the dead Catherine Armstrong, but the living Oswald Martin. The threats on his life, to say nothing of the notoriety, fatally affected the health of a man who'd already suffered so badly in the war. First, he fell victim to depression. He became afraid of the dark. He and his wife left Hay in 1924 and moved to East Anglia, but within a few years he was dead. And the 3 Armstrong children, 3 orphans, their mother murdered, their father hanged. For Major Armstrong was hanged.
In The Major, The Scone and the Dandelions, Aubrey Woods played Major Armstrong, John Rowe was Dr. Hinks, and Petra Davis, Mrs. Armstrong. Other parts were played by Danielle Allen, Timothy Carlton, Nigel Carrington, James Green, and Fraser Carr. Murder Most Foul is written by John Scottney and presented by Nick Ross. The producer was Mark Savage.